modern appliances, a comfortable bedroom with a rustic pine-framed king-sized bed, a guest bedroom, bathrooms, and a loft area that was set up as an office. Nearly every room in the home had a view of the lake. "I have one other thing to show you," Rafe broke the silence and motioned toward the door that led outside from the kitchen. He descended the steps and strode toward a small, barn-like structure. He pulled open the two large doors and stood aside, wearing a rare grin. Inside the detached garage sat a perfectly restored 1988 FJ62 Toyota Land Cruiser, its bluish gunmetal gloss clear-coat paint gleaming under the room's overhead LED lights. The vintage paint scheme contrasted tastefully with the flat black aluminum wheels, off-road bumpers, and roof rack. Reese's eyes widened at the sight of the custom off-road vehicle. He'd been forced to abandon his beloved Land Cruiser more than a year earlier as part of a one-man mission of vengeance that had left a trail of bodies that stretched from coast to coast. Since then, he'd driven Land Cruisers while working anti-poaching patrols for Rafe's uncle in Mozambique, but he hadn't had a vehicle to call his own. "It comes with a house. You know I'd never drive it, so you may as well." "Now I really don't know what to say." "All of a sudden you're the quiet one?" Rafe joked, referring to Utalivu, a Shona nickname given to him by the trackers in Africa. "Don't just stand there like a bloody idiot. Hop in." Reese walked forward as if he were approaching an extraterrestrial object. The door handle unlatched with a tactile and positive click. Whoever had done the restoration work had done it exceptionally well. The dark interior combined utilitarian finishes and materials with style and comfort. The keys were in the ignition. The 376 cubic inch, 430 horsepower General Motors LS3 V8 roared to life instantly, its throaty growl tamed by an effective ceramic-coated exhaust system that allowed the vehicle to maintain a reasonable amount of stealth, given its power. "Not bad for a Japanese import, eh?" Political correctness was not one of Rafe's strengths. "I love it." "This one's from Thorn," Rafe confessed, using the nickname for his father-in-law. "He's taken pity on you in your weakened state." "Where did he find it? Don't you recognize her?" Reese looked in the seats behind him, and then back to his friend. "It's yours. Oh, Clint couldn't bring himself to destroy her when you left California. He held on to it, just in case. When he found out you were alive, he reached out to Thorn through the Special Operations Association. Their Vietnam network is strong. Thorn had it shipped out here, but not before having it fixed up for you." "This is a bit more than fixed up. This is a work of art." "Glad you like it. Icon 4x4 did the renovation, so it should actually make it to town, unlike your stock original. I almost forgot. Look behind the seat." Reese switched off the motor and looked over his shoulder. Hanging in a purpose-built Grayman tactical rack behind the seat was a Daniel Defense Mark 12 with a Silencer Co. Omega suppressor and a Night Force 1-8x24mm ATACR optic mounted on the receiver's top rail. "Trouble seems to find you. I figured it would be wise to have more than that 9mm pea shooter in your holster." "You were not wrong, my friend," Reese said with genuine sincerity. "Make yourself at home and relax. The family is flying in tomorrow, and Dad is throwing a big dinner party in your honor. It will be great to see everyone." "Almost everyone. You remember my younger sister, Hannah. She's currently in Romania saving the world, but I think she's planning to come home for Christmas. It will be great to see her. And it gives me a few months to get into shape, as I remember she was always doing those ultra marathons. She won the Grand Traverse a couple of years ago, so you have a lot of work to do. That's no joke. I've always wanted to do that. Crested Butte to Aspen, right?" "That's right. 40 miles of ski mountaineering over the Elk Mountain Range. You have to have a partner for that one. Who'd she race with?" "Me," Rafe smiled. "And if they didn't remove your liver along with your brain tumor, you might want to bring it, along with a spare. You know how my family is." "If I find an extra, I'll be sure to bring it. I'll be at the shop if you need anything." "Hey, Rafe," Reese called out as his friend walked toward his Land Rover. "Yeah?" You might want to check the oil in that Defender. It's been sitting there for a few minutes, so it probably all leaked out. Rafe turned and smiled to himself as he saluted his friend with his middle finger. Chapter 2. Bangui, Central African Republic. Roman Dobrynin was not a man accustomed to waiting. Usually just the opposite. People waited on him. Subordinates, security personnel, even foreign dignitaries. He was the Russian president's man in Africa, or at least in the Central African Republic. In his mid-50s, he was a seasoned diplomat, having earned his stripes in the chaos that was Chechnya. He had proven himself to be an aggressive negotiator, unafraid to threaten and then employ the darker arts of manipulation to achieve his and Mother Russia's strategic goals. Technically a senior policy advisor in Russia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, he was their de facto senior man in the CAR. His official title was National Security Advisor to the President of the Central African Republic. Russia was a power on the rise in Africa, and Dobrynin had counterparts in the Congo, Ethiopia, Guinea, Eritrea, and Mozambique. With France all but abandoning its former colony, Russia and China were quick to fill the void. Arms deals, security training assistance, regional negotiations, lumber, diamonds, oil, gold, cobalt, and most important for Russia, uranium. Russia had vaguely disguised its intentions on the international stage, citing its involvement in the region beginning in 1964. Strategically located in the heart of the Dark Continent, the Central African Republic was the ideal hub from which Russia could move troops into neighboring countries while exploiting and exporting their natural resources. Dobrynin was there to ensure it was Russia, not China, that would control both the natural resources of this landlocked nation and, more important, their votes at the United Nations. Though rich in raw materials, CAR was one of the 10 poorest countries in the world. Its record of human rights violations, including extrajudicial executions, torture, female genital mutilation, slavery, human trafficking, the sex trade, child labor, rape, and genocide, made the country the perfect home for an outside power seeking to take advantage. It was a disenfranchised country ripe for exploitation. The call had come from the chief staff officer of the general director himself, which meant it was one of the few calls Dobrynin had to take. It was made clear that his guest was to be granted every professional courtesy and that he was coming in at the behest of the president. In Russia, the lines between official, unofficial, and private blurred to the point of virtual invisibility. This visit had all the trappings of the latter. Dobrynin knew that as deputy director of Directorate S in the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, Alexander Zharkov could be coming to CAR for a variety of reasons. He also knew the Zharkov name, and much more than the call he'd received from his own high command, that was reason alone to accommodate the intelligence officer. Dobrynin wanted to keep his head attached to his body. One did not offend a pakhan in the Russian Bratva and expect to stay above ground for long. Dobrynin watched the monstrous Antonov An-225 circle the airfield and begin its final approach. He remained in his vehicle until the aircraft had touched down and taxied to the Russian-controlled side of the airport, before disembarking the armored and air-conditioned Toyota Hilux. Straightening the tie on his Armani suit, he walked forward to meet his guest. Deputy Director Zharkov waited patiently as the aircraft hinged just behind the cockpit, pulling the entire nose of the massive plane skyward. It stopped when it reached 90 degrees, leaving the fuselage open to the elements. Most planes have cargo ramps in the aft, but the AN-225 has just the opposite. The nose gear slowly lowered the open beast to the ground, a unique design feature that allowed the largest aircraft in the world to load a staggering amount of cargo. A blast of heat off the tarmac nearly took his breath away, a clear indicator that he was no longer in Moscow. Its intensity carried the distinctive smell of conflict. His mind raced with possibilities. Scanning the tarmac, he saw a four-vehicle convoy of trucks surrounded by a perimeter of armed security, Spetsnaz. They had once been feared the world over as the premier special operations force of the former Soviet Union. Based on what was touted as the toughest training ever devised by a modern military, and because of their actions, the West would say atrocities in Afghanistan in the 1980s. They had now been relegated to protection duties for those who wanted to be surrounded by the myth that was Spetsnaz. A man in a crisp black suit walked toward him, flanked by two men from his security detail carrying AKM rifles.
"Director Zharkov, I am
Roman Dobrynin,"
the deputy director completed the sentence for him.
"It is a pleasure to make your acquaintance. Thank you for taking the time to meet me. I am sure you have pressing matters that require your attention. I have heard glowing reports of your progress here as National Security Advisor, advancing Russia's interest in the region."
"It is an honor to be of assistance," Dobrynin countered, his eyes moving up to the large airframe and then back to his visitor. "Are you alone, Director Zharkov?"
"Da,"
Zharkov confirmed with a wave of his hand, as if there were nothing odd about him being the single passenger on the heaviest airplane ever built. With 250,000 kilograms of payload capacity, the plane had completed its 14-hour flight from Moscow to the middle of the African continent and successfully inserted the senior intelligence official into the heart of darkness.
"No security detail?"
Dobrynin asked, looking back to the plane.
"I prefer to travel light and without the trappings of my position that could draw undue attention."
Zharkov was dressed comfortably in brown pants and a beige safari shirt with the sleeves rolled up, a canvas pack slung over his shoulder.
"Besides, with your clout and control in the area, I knew you would have security arrangements taken care of."
"Of course, Director. Shall we?"
Dobrynin motioned toward the waiting vehicles, struggling to decipher if the director's words were a compliment, a warning, or simply condescending. Zharkov nodded.
"I understand you were briefed on my requests."
"Da. We will take you to the hotel now, and tomorrow we will go to the mines."
Zharkov took in the sights of the bustling city, politely listening to Dobrynin drone on about his most recent diplomatic victories. A 5,000-man force of Russian military and contracted advisors were in the country, training the CAR Special Operations Forces on the finer points of counterinsurgency. Zharkov correctly assumed that meant a systematic campaign of terror aimed at keeping the dissidents in check and ensuring the current president remained in power and friendly to Russian interests in the country. At each stoplight, the cars were swarmed by children, arms outstretched, their faces hopeful for a coin or a piece of candy. Traffic was at its usual stop and go, broken down vehicles impeding their progress as scooters buzzed past like the swarms of insects that infested the nearby jungle. It was a country on its last breaths. Just outside the hotel, a small convoy of taxis lingered, each flying a small Russian flag on the front bumper, waiting eagerly for the opportunity to ferry guests to and from the airport. At the approach of the convoy, the hotel ledger's guarded gates opened, and the depravity of the streets was left in the dust. The driveway curved up to the entrance, and the outside world was forgotten. Old-world opulence, no doubt a vestige of the French colonial days, permeated every aspect of Bangui's finest hotel. Abundant marble and ornate tapestry were accented by rich African wood, polished to perfection, its gold inlay reflecting the late afternoon light.
"My men will show you to your room. I trust you will find your accommodations acceptable. Will dinner in 2 hours be convenient?"
"That will be fine, thank you,"
Zharkov nodded politely and proceeded to the elevator to the penthouse suite, two Spetsnaz and one bellhop in tow. As they arrived at the double suite doors, his new security halted him on the outside.
"Just a moment, sir."
"Open it," one commanded the bellhop. They entered the 6,000-square-foot suite, guns raised, then performed a sweep of every corner before pronouncing it safe to enter. Zharkov walked in and was not surprised to see two young girls who couldn't have been more than 15 in thin white linen dresses standing obediently by the king-size bed. This was Africa. He eyeballed their lean, underfed bodies, dark skin a sensual contrast to their scant dresses. A bottle of vintage 1987 Dom Perignon and fresh strawberries covered with chocolate were set at the table. He set his pack down and poured a glass of the cold, sparkling wine, savoring the taste, and glanced at the agenda sitting on the table. He looked back to the girls and was tempted, watching them shift nervously, fear radiating from their not-yet-vacant eyes. They still held a glimmer of hope. He shook his head toward the door.
"Ukhadi,"
he said.
"Von,"
the Russian said again, more firmly when they remained motionless. Not knowing a word of Russian, the girls stood there unsure of what to do. Zharkov pointed to the door.
"Out,"
he said, this time in English, pointing at the door. Understanding the international language of tone and gesture, the two girls made their way slowly past him, still unsure of what they should do and beginning to worry they had somehow upset the man they had been told to obey and pleasure. Opening the door for them, he told his new security detail he did not want to be interrupted until dinner. He'd been through enough prostitutes in this part of the world in his younger days, and he needed to stay healthy. His mind was on his mission. Chapter 3. Akyan Hotel, St. Petersburg, Russia. To Ivan Zharkov, information was everything. It had been information and his willingness to exploit it at all costs that had led to his position of power in the Bratva, the Brotherhood, known to the rest of the world as the Russian Mafia. His consolidation of St. Petersburg's Tambov gang was the result of well-timed intelligence brought to him by his eldest son, Alexander. Some even thought that, through Alexander, Ivan may have organized the arrests in Spain that took out the powerful gang's former leadership, though no one dared whisper such a thing. Ivan was the Vorv Sakon. No one, not even the government in Moscow, would cross him. It was Ivan's lust for information that persuaded him to send an emissary to Argentina, where a CIA officer was offering him valuable intelligence. That job fell to Dmitry Mashkov, a trusted bratok who had interrogated enough Chechens during his days as a paratrooper in the 104th Guards Airborne Regiment to know when a man was lying. If he could break a fanatical Muslim, stay alive in Kresty prison, and take out members of the rival Soltsenskaya gang, he was confident he could discern if some American desk officer was the genuine article. Dmitry spent 3 days interrogating the American in a Cordoba farmhouse and was convinced he was being truthful. Such an asset would be invaluable to Zharkov's operations. The trick was getting him from Argentina to Russia, which meant airports and customs officials. Via his son, Alexander, the elder Zharkov, had the appropriate influence to provide the man with a clean passport, but he would still have to traverse a series of international airports. These days, ever-present surveillance cameras using facial recognition technology made clandestine travel problematic. Luckily, Zharkov's friends in the South American drug trade were the best in the world when it came to moving contraband. They ultimately provided the solution. The former spy was moved overland from his Argentine hideout to Caracas, where the failing government was ripe with corruption. For a staggeringly low sum, he was shepherded through the airport's already lax security and loaded onto a Havana flight with